I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. With Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi backing an impeachment inquiry into President Trump, we started wondering about other presidents who have been impeached. Presidents Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton were both impeached by the House of Representatives and eventually acquitted by the Senate. Here's Chief Justice William Rehnquist back in 1999.
It is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said William Jefferson Clinton be and he hereby is acquitted of the charges in the said articles.
President Richard Nixon resigned in 1974 before the House could impeach him.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Joining me now to walk us through all of this history is John Meacham, presidential historian, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and co-author of the 2018 book Impeachment and American History. Welcome to The Takeaway, John.
Thanks so much.
Let's start with the way that impeachment came into our Constitution. What was the intent behind Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution, which spells out impeachment?
It was an attempt to add yet another check and balance to what was a document that, as James Madison put it, was designed to make ambition counteract ambition. And the sense was that there had to be some check on a lawless president. You can be impeached for bribery, treason, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. It's a phrase from the English common law. It's undefined, as Gerald Ford later said. A high crime and misdemeanor is whatever the House of Representatives decides at a given point it is.
And of course, the question then becomes, does the alleged conduct of President Trump match with the kind of behavior that you think the framers envisioned would be a reason for impeachment?
In this case, I do. It's always dangerous to conscript the founders into a common, into a contemporary issue. You can't say, James Madison, what do you think about abortion? That doesn't work. But in terms of the common sense of the language in the Constitution and the sense of the debates around it, reaching out to a foreign government for self-interest, and particularly perhaps linking official conduct to that outreach, would pretty clearly fall within what the framers were thinking. Remember, we know this thing has lasted 240 plus years. They didn't. And every government in the world, by and large, had tended to fall or fall into corruption because of foreign influence. Here you have this vast expanse of territory. We barely won the Revolutionary War. We now know the British only came back once, but they didn't know that. They had every expectation that the Spanish, the French, the British, perhaps the Russians to the west, would always try to exert influence over North America. And it was a pretty safe bet, given the history of Europe and the history of the world. So they were very careful about trying to keep officers of the new American government free from foreign influence.
Let's look at the earliest case of impeachment. Andrew Johnson, 1868. Can you pull out any parallels between the actions, the alleged actions of President Trump and those of President Johnson?
Extremely rough, but there is this echo. Andrew Johnson was an unconventional figure in that he was a Democrat who had run as on a Republican ticket, a wartime election of 1864. He was put on the ticket. Lincoln got rid of his first vice president, Hannibal Hamlin, well, the wonderfully named Hannibal Hamlin.
Yes.
Johnson was there to help with the border states, to reassure states that had not seceded but were on the knife's edge still, even at that late hour in the war, that Lincoln was not an entirely a creature of the political North. So as Johnson comes into power after Ford's Theater, he didn't share really the same values and vision that Lincoln had. And so he began fairly quickly to try to undo the verdict of the Civil War. He was a unapologetic white supremacist. He vetoed civil rights legislation. He opposed the 14th and 15th Amendments. And gave these kind of crazy conspiracy-minded speeches. So, you know, I'll let you draw the connection there. But what I think is important is he was undoing the makings of a consensus. And I do think President Trump has also attempted to undo what passes for a consensus in this country over the last 75 years or so.
Okay, so that's President Johnson. Fast forward a century. Does the investigation into Richard Nixon offer any insights as to how Congress may conduct impeachment proceedings against President Trump?
Well, that's the more interesting model in some ways. One of the things the last two impeachments have in common, and we'll be seeing this over the next several days, is they both had tapes. Right. And there was something about that level of evidence that I think helped convince people who are very wary of undoing presidential elections, even though this one is very much in dispute because of the Russian question, very wary. And so the evidentiary standard is one that's invented on the fly, basically, but will be interesting to watch. I think that Congress moved with great deliberation. When you look back on it, there were 25 and a half months between the break-in on June 17th, 1972, and Nixon resigning on August 8th. It was a case where, and this may happen too, I'm not sure quite how it would, but we have to watch this. It was a case where all the branches, the other branch as well, the judiciary branch, stepped in and played its role. I don't think President Nixon would have resigned and might not have been impeached, although I don't know that, if the Supreme Court had not ruled 8-0 that he had to hand over subpoenaed tapes. And so that was a case where the rule of law prevailed. For all the politics of 1973 and 74, the institutions held. And I think that is the test for us now, is will these institutions hold yet again?
And tapes, both in the Nixon case and in the Clinton case, is that what it would take in Trump's case for Republicans in the Senate to turn against him if there was a tape of him pressuring a foreign leader, for example?
You know, we have a reflexively partisan climate. And is it really that much worse than the post-Civil War, you know, the post-Civil War climate, or the Vietnam era climate, or the generational politics of the 1990s? In some ways, yes, in this sense. Having a dedicated and devoted and constant mechanism of defense, both in the digital world and the partisan media world, defending the president and trying to turn anything that in a different generation might have been a fairly straightforward assertion of wrongdoing or evidence of wrongdoing, turning that against the institutions is something that's more immediate for us. Mm-hmm. I'm skeptical that cable news is ruining the republic. I think that's too easy. I think it's a reflection as much as a driver of our partisanship. But that's kind of an academic point at this juncture. It's very clear that I think we're going to see very, very soon, perhaps even as we're speaking, we're going to see Trump supporters declaring total war on the Biden family, on Nancy Pelosi, on the entire mechanism of this check and balance. And one of the things we have to be very vigilant about, no matter where we stand in a partisan universe, is there a point beyond which a president should not go? And is this the point? And that's something that reasonable people can disagree about. But what's going to be particularly dispiriting is if we have this argument, not about is this the line over which he should not cross or go, but was there a line at all? That is, we dispute the facts. We dispute what you're saying about what he said. And that's one question. Then there's a nihilistic scenario, right? There's the question that, yeah, he did it, so what?
Yeah.
And we're gonna hear that. We're going to hear that a lot.
Might hear it from the president himself. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where citizens have to stand there, and we need to assess, is this reasonable and rational? And if so, then there'll be one result. But it also, just one final thing here.
Sure.
And this is clearly what happened in Johnson and Nixon and in Clinton. We're never going to get to an 80 or 90%, 95% level of support for one course of action or the other. You know, this is a big, disputatious, divided country. Disagreement is the oxygen of democracy. Madison once said, liberty is to faction what air is to fire. So we're going to be fractious. We're going to be divided on this. But the majority in this case does need to, I think, at least make an honest assessment of the facts, put it in context of what the framers wanted, and what do we want? Do we want a president who behaves in this way? And if the answer is no, then I think the course is fairly clear.
John Meacham is a presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Thank you so much for the history lesson and the perspective, John. Much appreciated.
My pleasure.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.